The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. You can go to progressiveradionetwork.com if you'd like to watch the show. Today, I've chosen not to have a guest on because I want to spend more time saying your thoughts, hearing what you have to say on several important issues. Of course, the latest on health and nutrition and healing, some life-saving information on thermography versus mammography. Also, an original, in-depth white paper investigative report, Do Vaccinations Provide a Lifelong Immunity? After all, we've been told the entire purpose of vaccination is to create immunization. In fact, they're used interchangeably. Oh, I just got my immune shot. Is it true? Could we be establishing a new standard of critical analysis today? I believe that is the case. I am hopeful that the people in this audience, being the most progressive audience in the United States, will use this information and share it with others. Post it. The article will be posted later today with all the scientific references and everything I'm going to share with you in my original investigative reporting piece. And this will be one of 10 that I'll be doing over the next 10 months to deconstruct the myths of one of the greatest public frauds ever, that vaccination equals immunization and lifetime protection, that they're safe and effective. Fact, they have no science on their side to support it, but they sure do have the New York Times, and they have much of the liberal media and the conservative media. They have all official government agencies, so today we take that on. Also a commentary from Professor John Cozy, The Triumph of Capitalism equals a jobless nation. Then one from Senator Bernie Sanders, Wall Street Secret Oil Games. This is something you didn't know about. And Professor Joseph Stiglitz, America's Costly War Machine, Fighting the War on Terror, compromises the economy now and threatens it in the future. Also, why would I vote first for Ralph Nader, but secondly for Ron Paul, knowing Ron Paul has so many things that, quite frankly, I'm opposed to. It's not what I'm opposed to as to why I believe that he should be considered. It's what all of us could benefit from, left and right, progressives and not. And I'll get into that in a few moments. So as you see, we have so much to cover. I intend to give as much time as possible to these issues. Please do not call in until we've gotten to that point where you're going to hear what I have to share on the issue. Then by all means, call in. I interviewed a gentleman at the very beginning of my career who invented a little device that a woman would place about the size of a quarter on her breast, and the device would read the temperature of the breast. The physician or nurse would then move the little device, which is a thermography device, around the breast, underneath, the sides, the top, and then take measurements. Based upon having done this thousands of times, he was confident that he could predict a tumor present before x-rays could find it or any physical manipulation, a palpation of the tissue could find it. He was right. And hence was born the entire concept of thermography. But what he was up against was an enormously lucrative mammography field, where women were encouraged to go in every single year, starting early in life, right through, because the idea was to find if you have a tumor now so you can take it out. According to Dr. David Jockers in Natural News, I'll quote this, "Thermography is a high technology tool that specifically measures inflammation in the body." By the way, inflammation, as an aside, can be measured by heat. For example, when we have a temperature, that's one of the ways that the body tries to kill viruses, bacteria, and pathogens, is to kill them by changing the temperature. If you get the temperature in the body a certain height, of course, you can kill the body. But up to that point, you can kill an awful lot of viruses, and that's why after you break your fever, you sweat profusely, and mucus comes out of the body in a rather large amount. In effect, the body is cleansing what it has killed. It's no different than diarrhea. Did you ever think of this? You're eating something. You're eating a salad, and you're looking at it. You see nothing on the salad, no speck of dirt, nothing that would inform you that there was a contagion. But 2 hours later, suddenly the stomach is upset. You can feel the effects that something is wrong. And maybe an hour later, you have diarrhea. And throughout the night, you have diarrhea. You may have some cramping. What the body is doing, the body, in its innate intelligence, has found the creature that you didn't. It has seen the microbe that missed your eye. How does it know that it is bad and should be expunged? But how does the body tell you this? It gets rid of it through diarrhea. That's why we have diarrhea. Or sweating. Or coughing. Coughing is to expel mucus and whatever in it out of the lungs. Or sneezing or runny nose. And what we do, we try to turn off the symptoms. If you turn off the symptoms, what you're doing, you're blocking generally the mechanism between the brain and that particular part of the body. And so you're telling the body, I don't want the symptoms. Yeah, but the symptoms are telling us something's wrong. So more than anything, inflammation in the body, heat in the body at a higher level than normal, that's what tells you something's wrong. I remember a dentist used to use thermography devices on the gums. And this was Dr. Joseph Issel in Germany. I've seen no dentists before or since who've done this. He took a simple device, and he would put it inside your gum, and he would very slowly take it from one end of the mouth, clear over and around to the other end. And then he'd say, ah, see there? And I'd look, and he said, that means there's a hidden focal infection. He would then go in, remove a tooth, or clean out the pocket, and sure enough, you would have this horrible smell, even with the masks on, that would come out when this was lanced or opened. And then he would go in with ozone in a tiny little needle, and he would disinfect the pocket or the root canal. And he was the first dentist I ever, well, he was the first doctor I ever saw using ozone to kill off local focal infections in the body. Now, here was his idea. If I can find the local infections in the knees or in the mouth, most were in the mouth, I can get rid of those infections. That allows then the body's immune system to go towards the cancer. If, however, you have an infection in your jaw, you have an infection in your throat, you have another infection in your intestine, then your body's immune system is spread so thin it can't concentrate on fighting the cancer. So by using Lincoln's bacteriophage, Coach's different therapies for stimulating immune response, getting in there with ozone and cleaning out these pockets, and using magnets, he then was able to eliminate the local infections and then put all the energy into the cancer. And that's why he had the most success of any human being that I'm aware of in world history of curing cancer. And there was a Professor Audier from Leiden University who did a report on it and independently verified that with terminal people, meaning you were given up for dead, 16.6% he would actually cure that terminal cancer. He had an 89% non-relapse rate, meaning you had cancer, he treated it, almost 90% would never get the cancer again. So, and that's how he did it. Now we come back to thermography. He used thermography all over the body. I would watch him take this little device. He'd put it on your ankle. He would put it on your vein. He said that if you have a blockage in the vein that you don't know about, the heat from where the plaque is building up would come through. He was so far ahead of his time. I mean, he was so far ahead with binoculars, you couldn't see him. Too bad. In any case, this thermography, this high technology tool, specifically measures inflammation in the body. Now, this test is particularly good for assessing active areas of cancer cell formation. Remember, by the time you have a cancer cell, which we all do every day, every person on the earth gets cancer cells every day, but the body comes along, identifies them, and through a very specific process, a natural killer cell activity, their specific cells will grab the cancer cell, engulf it, and digestively eliminate it. Unless, however, you have multiple stressors. Now, here's how this works. On one side of the equation, you're eating good food. You're eating a living diet. Meaning, a living diet means that 100% of your food intake and beverage intake comes from living foods. They have enzymes, phytonutrients, chlorophylls, antioxidants, protein, fats, carbohydrates, essential fatty acids, fibers. They're all good. They haven't been overcooked. Now, 75% of that is raw. There's a difference between raw foods, and I do not recommend 100% raw food diet for many reasons, and a lot of people promote it, but they're promoting it more out of a cult belief than they are science, especially nutrition and functional science. Oh, you bet you'll get much better on a raw food diet, but getting better, you could have gotten better without that radicalism. Then 25% of your food is lightly cooked, but the nutrients are actually released. You actually enhance digestion. For example, when you lightly saute a tomato in a tomato sauce, which is the basis of almost all your Mediterranean sauces, you can put your finger into the sauce without burning it. That's the heat necessary to create that sweet sauce, because as you heat your tomatoes with a low heat and you gently stir them, you're allowing more of the natural sugars to manifest. That is also true for garlic. In America, almost without exception, when you ask for garlic, it's going to be burned. And what you want is you want it translucent. You don't want it burned. Burn becomes acrid, it becomes bitter. Translucent, it becomes sweet. So the difference between a sweet garlic and a bitter garlic is heat. So again, the lycopene, which is the number one ingredient in tomatoes, is actually more plentiful and a greater bioavailability. Bio, meaning your biochemistry, availability, meaning the nutrients will be greater absorbed and greater utilized when you gently heat something than when you high cook it. But in America, we want fast foods, which requires high heat, fast cooking, or microwave cooking. That destroys the enzymes, destroys the antioxidants, alters the chemistry, and yeah, we get a fast food. We need slow food and low heat cooking. Hence, 100% of the meal you're eating is living foods, 75% raw, 25% cooked. Also, giving an example, try eating broccoli raw, Brussels sprouts raw, asparagus raw. The fiber is so pithy, it is so tightly bound, what is called lignocellulose, that only a small percentage of the indoles, the carbonyls, the nutrients that can protect our body from cancer, from cruciferous vegetables, only a tiny fraction is actually liberated so we can use them. Now, steam that for maybe 3 to 5 minutes. And then you have broken down the outer shell, allowing the nutrients inside to be much higher utilized, bioavailability. So for the person who says, no, I've got to eat this raw, okay, you're getting a lot of fiber, but you're not getting the nutrients. If I measure the blood chemistry, which I have thousands of times, the nutrients are low in people with mainly raw food, unless they're doing a lot of juicing, and then they're going to end up losing protein mass. You can, I've worked on this in so many angles. The difference is, as a food scientist, as a dietitian, registered dietitian, as a PhD nutritionist, I look at the science behind how we can make it better. I don't come at it as a cultist, like a macrobiotic, true believer. And when you do it that way, then you can have muscle mass, strength, endurance, strong immune systems, and living food diet. Now, go back to the point I was making. So when we are eating living foods, on one side of the scale, that means we have enzymes that are going to keep us more vital. We have more natural energy being produced. We're feeding the mitochondria, the energy factories, so we're going to have more vibrancy, more energy, less fatigue. That means the body can better prevent disease. We're not eating those high fried foods, the pizzas, hot dogs, hamburgers, french fries, colas, sugar, artificial sweeteners, alcohol. Not in our diet. Now we de-stress. We keep our cortisol levels low. What would cause us to have high cortisol levels? Well, insecurity, uncertainty, fear. Those will precipitate it up higher than anything else. A sense of foreboding, anger, vengeance, violence, all that spikes your cortisol levels. I counseled a person on Sunday afternoon out when I finished filming for about 3 hours. This person eats an impeccably good diet and walks, has good body fat muscle composition, but is now suffering from dementia. Person is not old and is totally confused by, why me, Gary? I said, just look at your life. You're stressed. You're going through panic at this point in your life because of your financial situation. And this has been going on. If you ate a perfect diet and if you took all your supplements, but if you were living day to day under severe stress, you're going to undo the benefits of the diet. And so quality of life, quality of values, quality of beliefs, and then not being stressed, that's what adds the positive checklist off. The average American eating a bad diet, under stress, insecure, uncertain, not connected with values that can sustain them emotionally and spiritually, and gee whiz, why do we have an epidemic of sick people physically and emotionally and spiritually in America? Where is the surprise? We should have had more. So along comes this device that can tell us at least where there is a temperature variations. And thermography is a scanning device that measures your body's surface temperature and presents the information as a digitized image. And this tool makes a digital map of your body and very accurately illustrates heat patterns. And these patterns can detect some abnormal conditions like cancer cell growth or active infection. Now, mammograms, which I'm 100% against, I don't believe any woman should get a mammogram. And we have the science in hand, the world's leading expert in the dangers of mammography is Dr. Sam Epstein. In fact, he asked me to do the introduction to his new book on this subject, and I just filmed him on this subject. If you saw all of the actual science, you would never take a mammogram. Mammograms look for anatomical changes in the breast, such as masses or lumps. Thermograms analyze for vascular changes in the breast. Now, increased blood into certain regions of the body increases the heat of that region. Areas of inflammation, cancer cell formation, and active infection have elevated circulation. Thermal imaging has a great ability to detect subtle physiological changes that accompany pathology. The body should naturally have thermal symmetry. Areas of asymmetry can indicate problems and are analyzed specifically for underlying pathology. Cancer cells divide very rapidly and demand increased blood flow and nutrient delivery. And the metabolic process in the body cannot differentiate between tumor cells and healthy cells. And this results in increased formation of blood cells around these active cancer cells. And thermography picks up this abnormal blood cell supply well before cancer gets large enough to be noticed as a lump or even a breast exam. Thermography can see cancer formation at the size of 256 cells, roughly the size of a pinhead. Mammograms cannot detect cancer until they're roughly 4 billion cells clumped together. It is estimated that thermography can detect cancer 10 years before mammography can identify a tumor. The breasts do not normally generate much heat. Healthy breasts appear purple during a thermographic exam, and this indicates very low heat levels. Red, orange, or yellow spots that appear during a breast thermography may indicate the presence of cancer and should be analyzed more closely. And it's been around for 30 years. And the data is based upon over 250,000 women that have been included in studies on this. And the sensitivity accuracy is over 90%. And the study showed that a persistent abnormal thermogram carries with it 2,200% higher risk of future breast cancer. And unlike mammograms, thermograms emit no harmful ionizing radiation. Mammograms, one of the more dangerous medical tools due to the high amount of ionizing radiation, and thermograms use infrared technology that is completely safe. And they do not compress the breast tissue like mammograms, and this compression that takes place during mammograms can cause cancer cells to break off and to create a malignant spread through the bloodstream. So that's just the latest to help save some lives and let you know the truth, because you're sure as Dickens not going to get that from the talking idiots on television who bring on these doctors without questioning them on the accuracy of what they say. Oh, and by the way, Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center, quote, "The number of young children admitted to hospitals or seen in emergency departments because they unintentionally took a potentially toxic dose of medication has risen dramatically in recent years, according to a new report out." Now, are they dying from vitamin overdose? Nope. They are getting sick and dying from prescription and non-prescription medications. And finally, a new antioxidant study findings have been published by scientists at the University of Patras and showing that, quote, "oxidative stress is involved in the pathophysiology of neurodegenerative disease and aging. Many species were studied, species meaning different types of antioxidants, and it was found that the tea family is high up on the list of things that can prevent your brain from aging from oxidative stress. So please get your antioxidants in the form of your teas. Now, before we go to our first break, tomorrow I'm going to be having Dr. Harvey Wasserman on to talk about the latest on Fukushima, but I'm going to give you a heads up that you have not heard anywhere. Let's see how accurate this is. To all the people now listening in Japan, and we have many listening in Japan and around the world, please do not believe anything that your government tells you about the safety of the Fukushima explosion. Here is the truth that your government, prime minister, the utility will not tell you. Global Research, quote, "Tokyo radiation exceeds Chernobyl. In some places, Japanese government and experts discuss evacuation." Now, we told you on this program about a week after the explosion that there was no way to contain the radiation from spreading throughout the island. When rain came, that radiation would go into the soil and then into the water system, and especially north of Fukushima, where they grow their rice and major food supply for the island. Quote, "Experts estimate that radiation leak from Fukushima near plant will exceed that of Chernobyl. The need to evacuate parts of the sprawling capital of 35 million may have once seemed an incredible prospect, but some experts say the possibility can no longer be ignored. Indeed, as Japan Times reported today, the Japanese government started discussing the potential need to evacuate Japan soon after quake hit. In the days immediately after the crisis began at the Fukushima 1 nuclear power plant, the government received a report saying 30 million residents in Tokyo metropolitan area would have to be evacuated in a worst-case scenario. That was according to a secret report from the Prime Minister. Quote, "It was a crucial moment when I wasn't sure whether Japan would continue to function as a state, unquote. Now, after the March 11th earthquake and tsunami crippled the plant, they instructed several entities to simulate a worst-case scenario. One of those assessments said everyone residing within 250 kilometers of the plant, a zone that would encompass half to all of Tokyo, and would have to be eliminated and clear across a Honshu to the Sea of Japan. They would all have to be evacuated. So where do we stand today? Are things getting better? Sorry, they are getting worse. While this is a worst-case scenario, the worst-case scenario is unfolding, in my opinion. What do I see? What I see is what we don't see. It's no longer in our news cycle. It's no longer news. Just like the Haitian earthquake and its victims, they're no longer in our news. So we assume that everything's fine. It is not. The Fukushima reactor has been spewing very high levels of radiation, nonstop 24/7. Now, let me ask you this, and you don't have to be a physicist to understand this. If the wind is blowing, and it's blowing the radiation, 250 kilometers is not far to blow. And that radiation has now hit almost every single area of Japan. I believe that the Japanese government should start making plans to evacuate all 30 million people out of Tokyo area. I believe that within the next year, if they do not do so, we will have, as we had with Chernobyl, where the Russian government downplayed and denied the damage, and then a million people died in the years subsequent to that. I believe that you will have a human genocide in the next 20 years, where millions of Japanese will die because their government did not want to go through the process of acknowledging the truth. Tomorrow we'll ask Harvey Wasserman his thoughts. I'm Gary Knoll. Now for one more thing, I'm going to go to our issue of the day. And then after this, we'll take a break and you can call in with your thoughts. The Obama administration is intent on applying supply-side principles. Now, you heard me many times in this program say that after a methodical, scholarly examination of economic trends and policies for the last 100 years, I can personally tell you I have not found where they work. It is a myth. If you give all the money to the wealthy corporations, that they will then take that money and create new jobs. They will open factories in communities around the United States, and they will create products and services that we need here, hence expanding our population's capacity to pay off their own debt and put extra money back in the economy. It's all a myth. The fact that someone you may respect or enjoy watching, a Bill O'Reilly, Sean Hannity, or someone else, Mark Levin, says it, doesn't mean that it's true. But Democrats say it also. One of the leading supply-side presidents, probably the most supply-side president, aside from George Bush, but as a Democrat, was Bill Clinton. Well, now Barack Obama is doing the same identical thing. As a result, they're trying to tell us that the American economy will get out of its present recession with supply-side economics. Give the money to the wealthy. Give them, you know, don't take away anything they have. Well, the entire theory is based upon the mere pop psychological belief that if you give a person money, she or he will invest it in productive ways. But nothing forces wealthy people to do that. And they haven't done it. And worse, never really have done it. Now, since creating jobs, it's not an essential business function. Only making money is. And getting financial incentives from government is merely another way of making money. Giving money to businesses will not end recessions or depressions. In fact, it is likely to prolong them, since businesses will not create jobs until it is evident that those jobs will result in profits. Just a moment for a little history lesson. During the California Gold Rush, merchants went to the camps only after gold was discovered, and they left when the gold petered out. They did not use the capital they acquired from the miners to open productive businesses to provide jobs to the now jobless prospectors in capitalist economies, capital is not acquired to be spent. It is acquired to be accumulated. Businesses do not exist to create jobs. Jobs are created by businesses only when it suits their purposes to make more profit. Beliefs in conventional wisdom are always dangerous. More often than not, conventional wisdom is wrong. But there are two kinds of conventional wisdom, pro and con. Every bit on conventional wisdom has its naysayers, and just as conventional wisdom can amount to nothing more than mere beliefs, so can the belief of naysayers. For instance, that today's economy is failing is rather evident, but many critics of it seem to believe that the problems with today's economy are of recent origin. I believe that's false. The economy today is little different in essence than it was in the 1600s when the colonists brought it with them from England. The horrors of England's 17th century economy then are exactly its horrors today. Wealth held in the hands of a few and poverty experienced by the many. High levels of crime infused throughout society, widespread unemployment, underemployment, and degrading employment. The destruction of human dignity, homelessness, hunger, and frequent wars fought by common people for the benefit of the merchant class. Prevalent discrimination of various kinds, governments which governs for the wealthy and not for the people in general. And although there have been short-lived periods when the people were led to believe that their prospects were improving, these periods have regularly ended in economic collapses that wiped out any gains the common people had acquired. The universal features of this economy are exemplified in just a little historical vignette. On January 24, 1848, gold was discovered, as we all know, if you've taken American history class. Oh, I forgot, the young people today, they don't have to take history. Oh, don't teach my little beautiful son or daughter anything about history. Teach them about how to surf on the Internet. Educate their thumbs, not their brains. Okay. But for the last generation that actually had a brain to educate, and you know who you are, well, you remember, of course, that it was James Marshall at Sutter's Mill in Coloma, California. And when people learned about the discovery, hundreds of thousands rushed to California. Wherever gold was discovered, miners collaborated to put up a camp and stake claims. Rough and ready, Hangtown, Portuguese Flat. They had all kinds of names. They sprang up, and merchants flocked to them and set up businesses in hastily built buildings, sometimes just lean-tos, even tents, and anywhere else serviceable to sell everything imaginable. Miners lived in tents and shanties and deck cabins removed from abandoned ships. Each camp often had its own saloon and gambling house. Women of various ethnicities played various roles, including that of prostitute and single entrepreneurs. At first, the gold was simply free for the taking. Disputes were often handled personally and violently. When gold became increasingly difficult to retrieve, Americans began to drive out foreigners. The state legislature passed a foreign miner's tax of $20 a month. That's an enormous sum for someone who hasn't had any luck getting gold. And American prospectors began organizing a tax on foreigners, particularly Latin Americans and Chinese. In addition, the huge numbers of newcomers drove Native Americans off their traditional hunting and fishing and gathering areas. In fact, I'm going to tell you a sordid little aspect. This coming spring, for 4 months, this March, April, May, and June, I'll be traveling around the United States. There are over 600 tribes on reservations around the United States. I intend to film all 600. I'll be having camera crews, probably 10 different camera crews, and I'll be taking a bus, and I'm going to go to as many as I can because I'm going to record their history from their elders, their state of life, their state of how women are treated, their judicial system, everything that goes on in a Native American's life that we can record and understand their story will be done. It's a mammoth project. I've wanted to do it for a long time. I wrote the book many years ago, Stop the All-American Genocide Machine, about the 1,337 treaties we signed with the Native Americans and broke every single one. And I just want to show what has actually happened historically in a long series of biographical sketches that I'll put up on the Internet on this. In any case, if you go back there, there's an ugly part of American history that no one talks about. No one. The huge number of Native Americans were attacked by miners, and this provoked counterattacks, and the natives were then slaughtered. Those who escaped were unable to survive and starved to death. Natives succumbed to smallpox, influenza, measles in large numbers. The Act for the Government of Protection of Indians, passed by the California legislature, allowed settlers. Now get this, they allowed settlers to capture and use natives as bonded workers and traffic in Native American labor, particularly that of young women and children, which was carried on as a legal business enterprise. Now let me repeat this so you understand what I'm saying. Native American villages were regularly raided to supply demand for young women and children. They were carried off to be sold. The toll on the American migrants could be severe as well. 1 in 12 49ers perished. The death and crime rates during the Gold Rush were extraordinarily high, and the resulting vigilantism also took its toll. And then came along something we're facing today, hydrofracking. But it was then called hydrolicking as a means of extracting the gold. And a byproduct of this was that large amounts of gravel, silt, and heavy metals and other pollutants went into streams and rivers. In many areas still bear the scars of hydraulic mining, since the resulting exposed earth and downstream gravel deposits were unable to support life. Now, the merchants made far more money than the miners. The wealthiest man in California during the early years of the Gold Rush was Samuel Brannan. He was a tireless self-promoter and a shopkeeper and a newspaper publisher. And about half the prospectors made a modest profit. Most, however, made little or wound up losing money. By 1855, the economic climate had changed dramatically. Gold could be retrieved profitably from the gold fields only by large groups of workers, either in partnerships or as employees. And by the mid-1850s, it was the owners of these gold mine companies who made the money. When the load petered out, the merchants abandoned the sites faster than the miners. The gold rush was over. Now, I have in the past, I've written about many of these horrid features of that economy, especially in abject immorality. Today, I want to discuss an obvious falsehood that still gets repeated, especially by Blue Dog Democrats, what I call Clinton and Obama Democrats, and most, but not all, of the people on the right. Politicians and business people alike, and certainly the talking heads like Neil Cavuto and others. And that is this: that businesses, not governments, create jobs. That's what they claim. This generic claim is, of course, obviously false, and its generality makes it grossly ambiguous. What precisely does it mean, especially since the politicians who utter it spend piles of money and time trying to get jobs that are not created by any business? No business created the jobs of congressman or president, so what sense does it make for such a person to claim that businesses, not governments, create jobs? The claim is utterly stupid. In fact, businesses have no interest in creating jobs. Consider the vignette described just now. Merchants flocked to the mining camps after gold was discovered, and they left when the load petered out. They did not use the capital they acquired for the miners to open productive businesses to provide jobs to the now jobless prospectors. In capitalist economies, capital is not acquired to be spent. It is acquired to be accumulated. Employees are merely means to that end, and whenever a business can accumulate capital without the use of employees, it will do so. That's why we've had massive outsourcing of American jobs, because when you don't have to pay a person a living wage with its benefits, you get to keep that money. When you can deny someone medical coverage, even if they're insured, by saying, oh, we don't insure that, you get to keep that money. They may lose a life, but you've made a profit, and that's what you're rewarded for. Nobody remembers the person who died because they didn't get the operation, even though they were fully insured because you denied it. Everybody celebrates your special bonus. And that is what has happened in large measure in America today. Businesses have found ways to accumulate capital without the need for American employees, and government has aided and abetted businesses in doing it. And I'm not talking about the small business person now. I'm talking about the mega corporations, the Wall Streeters, the big industrialists. So when a politician advocates giving financial incentives to businesses to induce them to create jobs, those politicians are involved in a ludicrous absurdity. All the proposal does is provide business with another tool for extracting money from common people without even having to deal with them. And the capital acquired by the businesses in this way will merely be added to the capital accumulation in their bank accounts. Bigger bonuses, buyout competition. Why would a business want to create a job with it and put that capital in jeopardy? To assume that businesses will use that capital to create jobs is a fallacy of supply-side economics, which incidentally is based on nothing but pop psychology. In conclusion, supply-side economics is based upon belief that if the government cuts taxes on the wealthy, they will invest their savings in new factories fitted with new technologies that will produce goods at lower costs, that newly hired workers will increase employment, and that more output will increase tax receipts. The economy will lift itself by the bootstraps, but there is no way to make sure the wealthy actually invest their wealth in productive enterprise, especially in the United States. This entire theory is based upon mere pop psychology belief that if you give a person money, she or he will do the right thing with it, namely invest it in productive ways. But nothing forces wealthy people to do that, and they haven't done it, and worse, never have, since creating jobs is an essential business function. Not at all. Only making money is essential, and getting financial incentives from government is merely another way of making money. So, take a look, as I've said many times on this program. Look at how you could help everyone and completely eliminate the budget. A, you don't have to increase taxes on anyone. Instead, we should have one flat 20% tax with no deductions allowed. That eliminates all the bureaucracy of the IRS. It eliminates all deductions, eliminates a 55,000-page contorted travesty of a tax code. So every corporation in the United States must pay 20% of its profits in taxes with none of these unique loopholes that allows General Electric not to pay any taxes. Secondly, you then have sales taxes. So if you want to buy something, fine. Luxury goods, you charge a higher tax. If you're that wealthy, you want a yacht, fine. Then you've got the money and you pay a higher tax on that. So that eliminates the tax burden on the average American, and we're not then take away all subsidies. All subsidies to the financial industry, all subsidies to the oil cartels, the energy cartels, the nuclear cartels, $36 billion alone this year to nuclear. Take away big agri's subsidies. Take away the health insurance subsidies from the insurance industries. Have a government-run single payer where the cost of administration is 1%. Currently, it's 33%. If you did that and you took away the military-industrial private contractor subsidies and you reduce that budget to what we actually need, you would save and accrue $3.5 trillion a year. That is triple anything anyone is now considering, and you wouldn't touch Social Security, Medicaid, or Medicare. And you would have single payer for those who want it. You want it private, you have it also because you pay for it. What a simple way. You think this is complicated? The answer and solution is not complicated. The convoluted way our political system works with the media and special interests, that's what's complicated. And we have these talking heads who don't seem to have anything in their head except talking points given to them on the left and the right. I'm embarrassed when I watch some of these programs on the left and the right, because they lack reason, they lack common sense, and there is nothing going to happen that's going to help us from their point of view. Now, why would I vote for Ralph Nader for president? Why did I vote for Ralph Nader for president? Because name me who else cannot be compromised by buying them off. Well, Ron Paul hasn't been bought off. But on the progressive side, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, Consumer Credit Disclosure Law, the Consumer Product Safety Act, the Co-op Bank Bill, the Federal Coal Mine Health and Safety Act, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, the Freedom of Information Act, the Funeral Home Cost Disclosure Law, the Law Establishing the Environmental Protection Agency, the Medical Device Safety Act, the Mine Health and Safety Act, the Mobile Home Safety Act, the National Automobile and Highway Safety Act, the National Traffic and Motor Vehicle Safety Act, the Seat Belts, National Gas Pipeline Safety Act, the Nuclear Power Safety Act, the Occupational Safety OSHA Act, the Pension Protectional, the Protect Your Pension, that's Ralph Nader, the Safe Water Drinking Act that Bill Clinton and Al Gore tried to eviscerate. That was created by Ralph Nader, the Tire Safety and Grading Disclosure Law, the Whistleblower Protection Act, the Wholesome Meat Act, the Wholesome Poultry Product Act, and 200 more acts. No human being in American history has ever done as much to protect our interest in an uncompromising way than one man, Ralph Nader. And yet all that we can say to Ralph Nader is, you're an embarrassment to us, you caused us the election. And I say, my God, if you were any dumber, you would be a brick. Ralph Nader is the only Democrat, when he was a Democrat, before he became an independent in a Green Party, that had the integrity not to become a corporatist Democrat, which is all that the Democrats have been for a long time, except for those who apologize for their acts. Now, I can go into everything Ralph Nader's ever done. I can go through the year he created it. In 1972, the Center for Women's Policy Studies. 1973, the Capitol Hill News Service, the Multinational Monitor, the Trial Lawyers for Public Justice, 1982, and on and on. You can put every member of Congress together and you can't equal what he's done. And yet he is considered irrelevant. He is considered a joke. Just like Ron Paul's considered a joke. Well, what do Ron Paul and Ralph Nader have in common? Ron Paul would take away the opportunity to arrest you and try you and create martial law and imprison you in the United States. He would close down all military bases abroad and stop all wars of aggression. He would stop our drone programs. He would stop torture. And he would close down the Federal Reserve. And he would stop all the banks and all the special interests getting loans. He would also protect our right of freedom of choice. He believes in holistic health, and he would take out the teeth of the FDA attacking the raw food people, and he would provide us with an opportunity for holistic preventative care. Now, on those issues, Ralph Nader and Ron Paul are in sync. On many, they are not. On many, I am not with Ron Paul. But show me anyone else on the right or left who's willing to at least do that, and that would be an enormous way to help some of the suffering. So when people say, why do you have anything good to say about Ron Paul? Well, because I take the time to look to see who could do what to help us and who would do nothing to help us currently. And the idea is nothing can be done to help us otherwise. I'm Gary Noll. I'm going to open up the rest of the show for your calls. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you. I'm going to go to your phones as soon as they get up on the board here for me. And just a couple announcements. We're going to have a wonderful dance party on Thursday evening. I'm looking forward to being there. I'll spend my first hour from 7 to 8 signing any of the books that you should bring, because people always like to bring books. I'll be happy to sign them. Even old ones, I don't care how old they are, I'll be happy to sign them. And then I'm going to be dancing. And I've selected the music. I'm mixing the music. I'm doing a lot of disco, but I'm also doing some old rhythm and blues to start it. I'm going to end with some a little more modern music. I'm going to have a whole hour in there of Latino and Caribbean music to dance to. It's all dance music. And it's going to be wonderful. And it's free. It's this station saying, and its management and its producer saying, thank you very much for all your support. And so it's a night to celebrate. That's it. Just come and have a great time. Single, couple, young, old, doesn't matter. If you enjoy dancing, and it's a green nightclub, all right, it's all green. So we found the best nightclub we could. I got all the music. I got the DJ. It's going to be wonderful. But we have to know you're coming, because we don't want a long line that has happened in the past outside. I've done 55 of these celebration parties in my career, and they've all been packed. This will be packed. But I want to make sure you have a chance not to wait in line, that you come in. So call 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065. Now, for our big event tomorrow, let me just mention that we're packed. However, it's going to be such an exciting evening. Starts at 5, try to be there no later than 4:15. Just make sure you get a seat. We're going to have ushers. We're going to have everything done real smooth. The knocking on the devil's door is 5 to 6:30. Then we bring in everyone else for the 7 to 8:30. Then we follow with the premiere of Death by Medicine at 8:30 to 10. And so it's going to be a wonderful big evening for any part of that you want to come. But there's always going to be people who have signed up who will not show. Always. So if you don't have a reservation, don't call us. Just show up. We have a will call window there. And after the first seating, any empty seats you can then get at the will call window. It's at the Ethical Culture Center at 65th and Center Park West. Okay, but don't call. No seats. We're sold out completely, but there will be no shows. And I don't believe that we should have an empty seat. Let's say hello now to James from Queens. Hi, James. You're on the air.
Yes, Gary. Good afternoon.
Thank you.
Yes. Listen, when I vote, this is the problem, because people don't understand the process. When you vote for an individual, you vote for their track record, especially politicians. You're supposed to find out what they've done in their life, whether they're a politician or they come from a private sector, or what have they done before you vote for them. When Barack Obama came, when he was running for the Democratic nomination, I asked myself, what did this man do? And I realized he didn't do anything, so I never voted for him. I voted for Cynthia McKinney, since she has a longer track record. So I guess the elite understand that when you put someone out in front who gives great speeches, the people get electrified and vote for them, instead of looking at their record, asking questions pertaining to their record. What have they done? Like you gave Ralph Nader, what he's accomplished, what he's done. And Ron Paul, if I remember correctly, he was in finance. I don't know too much about his record on his finance or his job as finance.
I have Ron Paul's entire voting record. I have John Kerry's entire voting record. Now, I have everything that Ron Paul ever voted on, every piece of legislation, and what I would agree with and what I would disagree with. There are things I absolutely disagree with Ron Paul, but those are not the issues that I feel are most important. The issues most important are, can a person help us by getting us out of these wars, out of this whole perpetuating terrorism by being in these countries and causing destruction? I have to look at what we can agree upon versus what we would disagree. Now, if he was pro-war, if he signed the Patriot Act, which he did not, and which Kerry did, and Obama, before he was president, I got his entire voting record, and I saw that his biggest supporters were the nuclear industry, Goldman Sachs, where he had voted for coal interest. He had a terrible pro-corporatizing agenda. I couldn't believe he was going to change all that completely, and he didn't. He has been 100% loyal to his big financial backers. So you're absolutely right, and I thank you very much for sharing your insights with us, James. Look at a person's background, because where they've been in the past is where they're going in the future. He wasn't in finance. He's a medical doctor. He has a background as a physician and as a what I would call contrarian libertarian. I believe that libertarianism, if you took off the contrarian part and you began to also look at how you can help the poor and help those in need and become a more humanistic and spiritual libertarian, or bring that in, then you take the same thing with the constitutionalist, and you take the same thing with the Greens, you take the same thing with the peace. You bring in those parts that work best in the new mindset, then you can go forward and have something good come from it. Thank you. Let's say hello now to Tony from Queens. Hi, Tony. Hi, speak up, Tony. You're on the air.
A whole lot today, because you said everything right on. I wanted to tell you that in New York, speaking at the UN, will be people from Fukushima saying pretty much what you said. And I hope that you can make a connection, if not actually going there, because you'll be so busy tomorrow.
All the people from Fukushima will be on the stage tomorrow evening making a presentation. All right? They're going to be there. Yes. And if you can't get there, we're filming it. You'll have a chance to see them and Carl Grossman and Vandana Shiva and all the other people are coming. Thank you, Tony. And for those of you who are saying goodbye now, we thank you for listening during this hour, but you can continue listening to the end of the show over ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Peter from Kingston. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Good.
First of all, I always want to thank you for all you've done for me and probably millions of other people. My question is, I'm interested in your perspective. I believe that who we elect for president has little impact anymore. I would love to see Ralph Nader and other wonderful people in there. If he got elected, what could he do against these powerful forces?
He would expose them. Right now, the powerful forces, why do you think Timothy Geithner, who was a part of the Glass-Steagall Act evisceration, which was the only law, along with the Commodities Future Trading Act, that protected us from allowing our savings and loan banks to become commercial banks and use it in venture capitalism. Why do you think that happened? Timothy Geithner and Larry Summers were brought in by Wall Street in order to protect their interest. So they're there to protect Wall Street's interests and see that the bailouts went to them. We gave the first bailout, $740 billion, to Wall Street and the banks. They did nothing with it to help the economy, and they didn't loan it to anyone. They didn't stop mortgage foreclosure. We then gave them $1.2 trillion in the quantitative easing one. They did the same thing. Then we gave them quantitative two, $3.2 trillion. Then we didn't even know until Bernie Sanders uncovered it and put it up online that secretly the Federal Reserve under Geithner and under Bernanke and the other Fed banks gave $16.1 trillion at no interest, 0.25 interest, no interest, to this hedge funds, equity partnerships, governments. So that's $20 trillion, all of which we're responsible for, also which dilutes the available capital. When you take new money, and that's what it is, and you put it into old circulation, you dilute the value of the dollar that's there. You also don't change anything. You don't create new jobs. You don't create new factories. You simply enhance your own capacity to make more money. So the idea that giving money, we've never given more money than $20 trillion to the wealthiest, and they created no new jobs. So that completely shoots down the idea that of trickle-down economics, give money to the wealthiest and give them tax breaks and they will spend it wisely and hire. They don't. So what Ralph Nader would do, what Ron Paul would do, what any combination of people like that would do, they would first surround themselves with progressive people who were populist-oriented and who could not be compromised or bought. Then they would put the issues in front of the public and say, here's our issue now. If you want to stay in a war, we will charge you an individual war tax. So every week you will get an amateurized statement, prorated, here's how much you're paying this week to stay in this war. Now, when you knew each week you had to pay a war tax, they would also do a graft tax, a corruption tax. This week, every American will get this bill in the mail that you must pay within 24 hours, but this purely how much money is going to be given to corrupt politicians in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and other countries. Bribe money, it'll be stolen, and last year it was $20 billion. So this is how much you're going to be taxed for nothing more than bribes, corruption, stolen money, and fraud. And what do you think the average American would do? You mean I got to pay for bribes and stealing? I got to pay for wars? Oh yeah, you got to pay for that. And here is the $1 trillion that no one's put on anyone's budget that we must pay now for the 900,000 vets who are seeking and receiving care and will be receiving that care for the rest of their life because of injuries, both physical and psychological, from the wars they've been in, that we put them in. I didn't know about that. Well, no, you didn't know about that because the magic numbers of Wall Street. Oh, and by the way, since we bail out companies that fail, especially banks, and they have enormous bets in derivatives positions out there. In America alone, over $100 trillion, we have to guarantee them. Well, there's not $100 trillion in the world. So we're paying, but did they actually spend money? No money was exchanged hands. But the bet was made that something would go up or down and change in value. So if they lose, you're going to pay for it. Why should we pay for it? We don't get the benefits if they win. Why should we have to be held accountable for the lose? Well, because that's how the system is stacked. Ralph Nader would explain that. And Ron Paul has explained that repeatedly through how the Federal Reserve is the most corrupt agency in the history of the world and the most dangerous. And yet the average Democrat, the average Republican refuse to acknowledge this because it goes against what their leaders are saying, support, you know, the Fed, support your government. And so even to have people have different voices in there brings a different dialogue and further exposes the problem. I hope that answers your question. Peter from Kingston, thank you very much. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Very much appreciate you all tuning in. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. And remember, you want to come to that dance party, call 877-627-5065. It's going to be a lot of fun, and it's totally free to come in the door. If you want to buy water or wine, you got to pay for that. But everything is free. It's on us, way of saying thank you. Have a nice day, everyone.
The Gary Nall Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matthew Bogart. All shows are archived by Kyle Pollard. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Jason Tablefeld.